Here the orator was interrupted by irrepressible and almost frantic applause. Of course, it was not the whole audience, but a good half of it applauded. The fathers and mothers present applauded. Shrieks and exclamations were heard from the gallery, where the ladies were sitting. Handkerchiefs were waved. The president began ringing his bell with all his might. He was obviously irritated by the behavior of the audience, but did not venture to clear the court as he had threatened. Even persons of high position, old men with stars on their breasts, sitting on specially reserved seats behind the judges, applauded the orator and waved their handkerchiefs. So that when the noise died down, the president confined himself to repeating his stern threat to clear the court, and Fetyukovich, excited and triumphant, continued his speech. Gentlemen of the jury, you remember that awful night of which so much has been said to day, when the sun got over the fence and stood face to face with the enemy and persecutor who had begotten him. I insist most emphatically it was not for money he ran to his father's house. The charge of robbery is an absurdity, as I proved before. And it was not to murder him he broke into the house, oh, no. If he had had that design he would, at least, have taken the precaution of arming himself beforehand. The brass pestle he caught up instinctively without knowing why he did it. Granted that he deceived his father by tapping at the window, granted that he made his way in, I've said already that I do not for a moment believe that legend, but let it be so, let us suppose it for a moment. Gentlemen, I swear to you by all that's holy, if it had not been his father, but an ordinary enemy, he would, after running through the rooms and satisfying himself that the woman was not there, have made off, post haste, without doing any harm to his rival. He would have struck him, pushed him away perhaps, nothing more, for he had no thought and no time to spare for that. What he wanted to know was where she was. But his father, the mere sight of the father who had hated him from his childhood, had been his enemy, his persecutor, and now his unnatural rival, was enough. A feeling of hatred came over him involuntarily, irresistibly, clouding his reason. It all surged up in one moment. It was an impulse of madness and insanity, but also an impulse of nature, irresistibly and unconsciously, like everything in nature, avenging the violation of its eternal laws. But the prisoner even then did not murder him. I maintain that, I cry that aloud. No, he only brandished the pestle in a burst of indignant disgust, not meaning to kill him, not knowing that he would kill him. Had he not had this fatal pestle in his hand, he would have only knocked his father down perhaps, but would not have killed him. As he ran away, he did not know whether he had killed the old man. Such a murder is not a murder. Such a murder is not a parricide. No, the murder of such a father cannot be called parricide. Such a murder can only be reckoned parricide by prejudice. But I appeal to you again and again from the depths of my soul, did this murder actually take place? Gentlemen of the jury, if we convict and punish him, he will say to himself, these people have done nothing for my bringing up, for my education, nothing to improve my lot, nothing to make me better, nothing to make me a man. These people have not given me to eat and to drink, have not visited me in prison and nakedness, and here they have sent me to penal servitude. I am quits, I owe them nothing now, and owe no one anything forever. They are wicked and I will be wicked. They are cruel and I will be cruel. That is what he will say, gentlemen of the jury. And I swear, by finding him guilty you will only make it easier for him, you will ease his conscience, he will curse the blood he has shed and will not regret it. At the same time you will destroy in him the possibility of becoming a new man, for he will remain in his wickedness and blindness all his life. But do you want to punish him fearfully, terribly, with the most awful punishment that could be imagined, and at the same time to save him and regenerate his soul? If so, overwhelm him with your mercy. You will see, you will hear how he will tremble and be horror-struck. How can I endure this mercy? How can I endure so much love? Am I worthy of it? That's what he will exclaim. Oh, I know that heart, that wild but grateful heart, gentlemen of the jury. It will bow before your mercy, it thirsts for a great and loving action, it will melt and mount upwards. There are souls which, in their limitation, blame the whole world. But subdue such a soul with mercy, show it love, and it will curse its past, for there are many good impulses in it. Such a heart will expand and see that God is merciful and that men are good and just. He will be horror stricken, he will be crushed by remorse and the vast obligation laid upon him henceforth. And he will not say then, I am quits, but will say, I am guilty in the sight of all men and am more unworthy than all. With tears of penitence and poignant, tender anguish, he will exclaim, others are better than I. They wanted to save me, not to ruin me. Oh, this act of mercy is so easy for you, for in the absence of anything like real evidence it will be too awful for you to better acquit 10 guilty men than punish one innocent man. Do you hear? Do you hear that majestic voice from the past century of our glorious history? It is not for an insignificant person like me to remind you that the Russian court does not exist for the punishment only, but also for the salvation of the criminal. Let other nations think of retribution and the letter of the law, we will cling to the spirit and the meaning, the salvation and the reformation of the lost. If this is true, if Russia and her justice are such, she may go forward with good cheer. Do not try to scare us with your frenzied troikas from which all the nations stand aside in disgust. Not a runaway troika, but the stately chariot of Russia will move calmly and majestically to its goal. In your hands is the fate of my client, in your hands is the fate of Russian justice. You will defend it, you will save it, you will prove that there are men to watch over it, that it is in good hands. Chapter 14. The peasants stand firm. This was how Fetyukovich concluded his speech, and the enthusiasm of the audience burst like an irresistible storm. It was out of the question to stop it. The women wept, many of the men wept too, even two important personages shed tears. The president submitted, and even postponed ringing his bell. The suppression of such an enthusiasm would be the suppression of something sacred, as the ladies cried afterwards. The orator himself was genuinely touched. And it was at this moment that Ippolit Kirillovich got up to make certain objections. People looked at him with hatred. What? What's the meaning of it? He positively dares to make objections, the ladies babbled. But if the whole world of ladies, including his wife, had protested, he could not have been stopped at that moment. He was even unintelligible, he gasped for breath, could hardly speak clearly, lost the thread. But he soon recovered himself. Of this new speech of his I will quote only a few sentences. Apostrophe. I am reproached with having woven a romance. But what is this defense if not one romance on the top of another? All that was lacking was poetry. Fyodor Pavlovich, while waiting for his mistress, tears open the envelope and throws it on the floor. We are even told what he said while engaged in this strange act. Is not this a flight of fancy? And what proof have we that he had taken out the money? Who heard what he said? The weak-minded idiot, Smerdyakov, transformed into a Byronic hero, avenging society for his illegitimate birth. Isn't this a romance in the Byronic style? And the son who breaks into his father's house and murders him without murdering him is not even a romance. This is a sphinx setting us a riddle which he cannot solve himself. If he murdered him, he murdered him, and what's the meaning of his murdering him without having murdered him? Who can make head or tail of this? Then we are admonished that our tribune is a tribune of true and sound ideas, and from this tribune of sound ideas is heard a solemn declaration that to call the murder of a father parricide is nothing but a prejudice. But if parricide is a prejudice, and if every child is to ask his father why he is to love him, what will become of us? What will become of the foundations of society? What will become of the family? Parricide, it appears, is only a bogey of Moscow merchants' wives. The most precious, the most sacred guarantees for the destiny and future of Russian justice are presented to us in a perverted and frivolous form, simply to attain an object, to obtain the justification of something which cannot be justified. Oh, crush him by mercy, cries the counsel for the defense. But that's all the criminal wants, and tomorrow it will be seen how much he is crushed. And is not the counsel for the defense too modest in asking only for the acquittal of the prisoner? Why not found a charity in the honor of the parricide to commemorate his exploit among future generations? Religion and the gospel are corrected, that's all mysticism, we are told, and ours is the only true Christianity which has been subjected to the analysis of reason and common sense. And so they set up before us a false semblance of Christ. What measure ye mete, so it shall be meted unto you again, cried the counsel for the defense, and instantly deduces that Christ teaches us to measure as it is measured to us, and this from the tribune of truth and sound sense. We peep into the gospel only on the eve of making speeches, in order to dazzle the audience by our acquaintance with what is, anyway, a rather original composition, which may be of use to produce a certain effect, all to serve the purpose. But what Christ commands us is something very different. He bids us beware of doing this, because the wicked world does this, but we ought to forgive and to turn the other cheek, and not to measure to our persecutors as they measure to us. This is what our God has taught us, and not that to forbid children to murder their fathers is a prejudice. And we will not from the tribune of truth and good sense correct the gospel of our Lord, whom the counsel for the defense deigns to call only the crucified lover of humanity, in opposition to all Orthodox Russia, which calls to him, "For thou art our God." At this the president intervened and checked the overzealous speaker, begging him not to exaggerate, not to overstep the bounds, and so on, as presidents always do in such cases. The audience, too, was uneasy. The public was restless. There were even exclamations of indignation. Fetyukovich did not so much as reply. He only mounted the tribune to lay his hand on his heart and, with an offended voice, utter a few words full of dignity. He only touched again, lightly and ironically, on romancing and psychology, and in an appropriate place quoted, "Jupiter, you are angry, therefore you are wrong," which provoked a burst of approving laughter in the audience. For Ippolit Kirillovich was by no means like Jupiter. Then, apropos of the accusation that he was teaching the young generation to murder their fathers, Fetyukovich observed, with great dignity, that he would not even answer. As for the prosecutor's charge of uttering unorthodox opinions, Fetyukovich hinted that it was a personal insinuation and that he had expected in this court to be secure from accusations damaging to my reputation as a citizen and a loyal subject. But at these words the president pulled him up, too, and Fetyukovich concluded his speech with a bow, amid a hum of approbation in the court. And Ippolit Kirillovich was, in the opinion of our ladies, crushed for good. Then the prisoner was allowed to speak. Matthias stood up, but said very little. He was fearfully exhausted, physically and mentally. The look of strength and independence with which he had entered in the morning had almost disappeared. He seemed as though he had passed through an experience that day, which had taught him for the rest of his life something very important he had not understood till then. His voice was weak, he did not shout as before. In his words there was a new note of humility, defeat and submission. "What am I to say, gentlemen of the jury? The hour of judgment has come for me, I feel the hand of God upon me. The end has come to an erring man. But, before God, I repeat to you, I am innocent of my father's blood. For the last time I repeat, it wasn't I killed him. I was erring, but I loved what is good. Every instant I strove to reform, but I lived like a wild beast. I thank the prosecutor. He told me many things about myself that I did not know, but it's not true that I killed my father. The prosecutor is mistaken. I thank my counsel, too. I cried listening to him, but it's not true that I killed my father, and he needn't have supposed it. And don't believe the doctors. I am perfectly sane, only my heart is heavy. If you spare me, if you let me go, I will pray for you. I will be a better man. I give you my word before God I will. And if you will condemn me, I'll break my sword over my head myself and kiss the pieces. But spare me, do not rob me of my God. I know myself, I shall rebel. My heart is heavy, gentlemen. Spare me. He almost fell back in his place, his voice broke. He could hardly articulate the last phrase. Then the judges proceeded to put the questions and began to ask both sides to formulate their conclusions. But I will not describe the details. At last the jury rose to retire for consultation. The president was very tired, and so his last charge to the jury was rather feeble. Be impartial, don't be influenced by the eloquence of the defense, but yet weigh the arguments. Remember that there is a great responsibility laid upon you, and so on and so on. The jury withdrew and the court adjourned. People could get up, move about, exchange their accumulated impressions, refresh themselves at the buffet. It was very late, almost 1 o'clock in the night, but nobody went away. The strain was so great that no one could think of repose. All waited with sinking hearts, though that is, perhaps, too much to say, for the ladies were only in a state of hysterical impatience and their hearts were untroubled. An acquittal, they thought, was inevitable. They all prepared themselves for a dramatic moment of general enthusiasm. I must own there were many among the men, too, who were convinced that an acquittal was inevitable. Some were pleased, others frowned, while some were simply dejected, not wanting him to be acquitted. Fetyukovich himself was confident of his success. He was surrounded by people congratulating him and fawning upon him. There are, he said to one group, as I was told afterwards, there are invisible threads binding the counsel for the defense with the jury. One feels during one's speech if they are being formed. I was aware of them. They exist. Our cause is won. Set your mind at rest. What will our peasants say now? Said one stout, cross-looking, pock-marked gentleman, a landowner of the neighborhood, approaching a group of gentlemen engaged in conversation. But they are not all peasants. There are 4 government clerks among them. Yes, there are clerks, said a member of the district council, joining the group. And do you know that Nazaryev, the merchant with the medal, a juryman? What of him? He is a man with brains. But he never speaks. He is no great talker, but so much the better. There's no need for the Petersburg man to teach him. He could teach all Petersburg himself. He's the father of 12 children. Think of that. Upon my word, you don't suppose they won't acquit him? One of our young officials exclaimed in another group. They'll acquit him for certain, said a resolute voice. It would be shameful, disgraceful, not to acquit him, cried the official. Suppose he did murder him, there are fathers and fathers. And, besides, he was in such a frenzy. He really may have done nothing but swing the pestle in the air, and so knocked the old man down. But it was a pity they dragged the valet in. That was simply an absurd theory. If I'd been in Fetyukovich's place, I should simply have said straight out, he murdered him, but he is not guilty, hang it all. That's what he did, only without saying, hang it all. No, Mihail Semyonovich, he almost said that, too, put in a third voice. Why, gentlemen, in Lent an actress was acquitted in our town who had cut the throat of her lover's lawful wife. Oh, but she did not finish cutting it. That makes no difference. She began cutting it. What did you think of what he said about children? Splendid. Wasn't it? Splendid. And about mysticism, too. Oh, drop mysticism, do. Cried someone else, think of Ippolite and his fate from this day forth. His wife will scratch his eyes out too, morrow for Mitya's sake. Is she here? What an idea. If she'd been here she'd have scratched them out in court. She is at home with toothache. He he he. He he he. In a third group, I dare say they will acquit Mitenka, after all. I should not be surprised if he turns the metropolis upside down to morrow. He will be drinking for 10 days. Oh, the devil. The devil's bound to have a hand in it. Where should he be if not here? Well, gentlemen, I admit it was eloquent. But still it's not the thing to break your father's head with a pestle. Or what are we coming to? The chariot. Do you remember the chariot? Yes, he turned a cart into a chariot. And tomorrow he will turn a chariot into a cart, just to suit his purpose. What cunning chaps there are nowadays. Is there any justice to be had in Russia? But the bell rang. The jury deliberated for exactly an hour, neither more nor less. A profound silence reigned in the court as soon as the public had taken their seats. I remember how the jurymen walked into the court. At last. I won't repeat the questions in order, and, indeed, I have forgotten them. I remember only the answer to the president's first and chief question. Did the prisoner commit the murder for the sake of robbery and with premeditation? I don't remember the exact words. There was a complete hush. The foreman of the jury, the youngest of the clerks, pronounced, in a clear, loud voice, amidst the deathlike stillness of the court, "Yes, guilty." And the same answer was repeated to every question, "Yes, guilty." And without the slightest extenuating comment. This no one had expected. Almost everyone had reckoned upon a recommendation to mercy, at least. The death-like silence in the court was not broken, all seemed petrified, those who desired his conviction as well as those who had been eager for his acquittal. But that was only for the first instant, and it was followed by a fearful hubbub. Many of the men in the audience were pleased. Some were rubbing their hands with no attempt to conceal their joy. Those who disagreed with the verdict seemed crushed, shrugged their shoulders, whispered, but still seemed unable to realize this. But how shall I describe the state the ladies were in? I thought they would create a riot. At first they could scarcely believe their ears. Then suddenly the whole court rang with exclamations, "What's the meaning of it? What next?" They leapt up from their places. They seemed to fancy that it might be at once reconsidered and reversed. At that instant Mitya suddenly stood up and cried in a heart-rending voice, stretching his hands out before him, "I swear by God and the dreadful day of judgment I am not guilty of my father's blood. Katya, I forgive you. Brothers, friends, have pity on the other woman." He could not go on, and broke into a terrible sobbing wail that was heard all over the court in a strange, unnatural voice unlike his own. From the farthest corner at the back of the gallery came a piercing shriek. It was Grushenka. She had succeeded in begging admittance to the court again before the beginning of the lawyer's speeches. Mitya was taken away. The passing of the sentence was deferred till next day. The whole court was in a hubbub, but I did not wait to hear. I only remember a few exclamations I heard on the steps as I went out. He'll have a 20 years trip to the mines. Not less. Well, our peasants have stood firm. And have done for our Mitya. Epilogue. Chapter 1, plans for Mitya's escape. Very early, at 9 o'clock in the morning, 5 days after the trial, Alyosha went to Katerina Ivanovna's to talk over a matter of great importance to both of them, and to give her a message. She sat and talked to him in the very room in which she had once received Grushenka. In the next room Ivan Fyodorovich lay unconscious in a high fever. Katerina Ivanovna had immediately after the scene at the trial ordered the sick and unconscious man to be carried to her house, disregarding the inevitable gossip and general disapproval of the public. One of two relations who lived with her had departed to Moscow immediately after the scene in court. The other remained. But if both had gone away, Katerina Ivanovna would have adhered to her resolution, and would have gone on nursing the sick man and sitting by him day and night. Varvinsky and Hertz and Stube were attending him. The famous doctor had gone back to Moscow, refusing to give an opinion as to the probable end of the illness. Though the doctors encouraged Katerina Ivanovna and Alyosha, it was evident that they could not yet give them positive helps of recovery. Alyosha came to see his sick brother twice a day. But this time he had specially urgent business, and he foresaw how difficult it would be to approach the subject, yet he was in great haste. He had another engagement that could not be put off for that same morning, and there was need of haste. They had been talking for a quarter of an hour. Katerina Ivanovna was pale and terribly fatigued, yet at the same time in a state of hysterical excitement. She had a presentiment of the reason why Alishaw had come to her. "Don't worry about his decision," she said, with confident emphasis to Alishaw. "One way or another he is bound to come to it. He must escape. That unhappy man, that hero of honor and principle, not he, not Dmitri Fyodorovich, but the man lying the other side of that door, who has sacrificed himself for his brother," Katya added, with flashing eyes, "told me the whole plan of escape long ago. You know he has already entered into negotiations. I've told you something already. You see, it will probably come off at the third etape from here, when the party of prisoners is being taken to Siberia. Oh, it's a long way off yet. Ivan Fyodorovich has already visited the superintendent of the third etape. But we don't know yet who will be in charge of the party, and it's impossible to find that out so long beforehand. Tomorrow, perhaps, I will show you in detail the whole plan which Ivan Fyodorovich left me on the eve of the trial in case of need. That was when, do you remember? You found us quarreling. He had just gone downstairs. But seeing you, I made him come back, do you remember? Do you know what we were quarreling about then?"
"No, I don't," said Alishaw. "Of course he did not tell you. It was about that plan of escape. He had told me the main idea 3 days before, and we began quarreling about it at once and quarreled for 3 days. We quarreled because, when he told me that if Dmitri Fyodorovich were convicted he would escape abroad with that creature, I felt furious at once. I can't tell you why, I don't know myself why. Oh, of course, I was furious then about that creature, and that she, too, should go abroad with Dmitri." Katerina Ivanovna exclaimed suddenly, her lips quivering with anger. "As soon as Ivan Fyodorovich saw that I was furious about that woman, he instantly imagined I was jealous of Dmitri and that I still loved Dmitri. That is how our first quarrel began. I would not give an explanation, I could not ask forgiveness. I could not bear to think that such a man could suspect me of still loving that. And when I myself had told him long before that I did not love Dmitri, that I loved no one but him. It was only resentment against that creature that made me angry with him. 3 days later, on the evening you came, he brought me a sealed envelope, which I was to open at once, if anything happened to him. Oh, he foresaw his illness. He told me that the envelope contained the details of the escape, and that if he died or was taken dangerously ill, I was to save Mitya alone. Then he left me money, nearly 10,000, those notes to which the prosecutor referred in his speech, having learned from someone that he had sent them to be changed. I was tremendously impressed to find that Ivan Fyodorovich had not given up his idea of saving his brother, and was confiding this plan of escape to me, though he was still jealous of me and still convinced that I loved Mitya. Oh, that was a sacrifice. No, you cannot understand the greatness of such self-sacrifice, Alexei Fyodorovich. I wanted to fall at his feet in reverence, but I thought at once that he would take it only for my joy at the thought of Mitya's being saved, and he certainly would have imagined that, and I was so exasperated at the mere possibility of such an unjust thought on his part that I lost my temper again, and instead of kissing his feet, flew into a fury again. Oh, I am unhappy. It's my character, my awful, unhappy character. Oh, you will see, I shall end by driving him, too, to abandon me for another with whom he can get on better, like Dmitri. But, no, I could not bear it, I should kill myself. And when you came in then, and when I called to you and told him to come back, I was so enraged by the look of contempt and hatred he turned on me that, do you remember? I cried out to you that it was he alone who had persuaded me that his brother Dmitri was a murderer. I said that malicious thing on purpose to wound him again. He had never, never persuaded me that his brother was a murderer. On the contrary, it was I who persuaded him. Oh, my vile temper was the cause of everything. I paved the way to that hideous scene at the trial. He wanted to show me that he was an honorable man, and that, Even if I loved his brother, he would not ruin him for revenge or jealousy. So he came to the court. I am the cause of it all, I alone am to blame.